Good morning, everyone. I'm Reva Winkler. I'm the Senior Director of Performance Measures here at the National Quality Forum, and we welcome all of you joining us here today for this meeting of the Steering Committee for Perinatal Reproductive Health, our endorsement maintenance project for 2011. Apparently, two of our colleagues are experiencing travel delays, and so they will be joining us when those are corrected and they arrive in town. But just a couple of things to orient you. This call, as you notice, we're on the phone. This is an open and public call. Anyone in out there could be calling in and listening in to your conversation. This discussion is also being recorded and will be transcribed, and the transcript will be posted on our website. So everything you say is on the record. We will be giving folks on the phone and anybody in the audience here an opportunity for public comment at different opportunities through the agenda as we go forward. So I wanted you to be aware of your audience might be a little bigger than in this just in this room. So with that, I think it's time for us to get to know each other. And so I would like to turn it over to Ann Hammersmith, who is our NQF in-house counsel. And we will do introductions and disclosures. Ann?
Good morning, everyone. If you recall, several months ago, you received a conflict of interest disclosure form. What we'd like to do now is go around the table, have you introduce yourselves, tell us who you're with, and disclose anything that you believe is relevant regarding your service on this committee. We do not expect you to reach out your CV to us, just things that are relevant. We are particularly interested in your oral disclosure of any consulting work that may be relevant to the matters before this committee, any grants or contracts, and any speaking engagements that are relevant to the matters before this committee. I'd like to remind you of two things before we begin the disclosures. You serve as an individual on this committee. Very often, committee members will say, I am Susie Smith, and I am here representing the American College of whatever. You are not here representing anybody but yourselves. You sit as an expert. You don't represent the interests of your employer or of someone who may have nominated you for service on the committee. The other thing that I'd like to remind you of also relates to something that I often hear committee members say, which is, I have no financial conflict of interest. Certainly, a financial conflict of interest is important and relevant, but for the purposes of the kind of work we do in these committees, it is possible to have an apparent or real conflict of interest where no money is involved whatsoever. You may have served on a committee. You may have done work with a professional organization where you were uncompensated, but you have a very direct interest in it, perhaps to the point where there might be some question about objectivity even. So those kinds of things are also relevant to your disclosure. So it's not just whether or not you have received money. So with that, I'm going to start with the chair, and if we could just go around the table.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Laura Riley. I'm a high-risk obstetrician at Mass General Hospital. That is probably my major disclosure is I'm at Massachusetts General Hospital, and there are two measures put forward by that hospital. The only thing I have to do with that is that I'm a doctor there, and so I have to do those measures. I'm also an active participant at the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, but I don't have anything particularly else.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Carol Sakala. I'm Director of Programs at Childbirth Connection. We prioritize performance measurement as a strategy for maternity care quality improvement, and are involved in things such as being active participants in NQF and working with ACOG and offices on Capitol Hill for a bill partnering to improve maternity care quality. I would say with respect to disclosure, my interest is in bringing good measures into the pipeline and having them be used to improve quality. I don't know that there are specific concerns. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Baylett. I'm a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Metro Health Medical Center in Cleveland, associated with Case Western University. I think the only thing I have in terms of disclosures is, along with Dr. Grobman, I'm co-PI for the APEX study from the Maternal Fetal Network. This is a study looking at developing new measures and validating older, more established measures. This has not yet been presented or published, and none of the measures that we're discussing for the study are being presented at this meeting.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Gregory. I'm also a high-risk specialist. I am at Cedars Sinai Medical Center and UCLA School of Medicine and School of Public Health. I had an AHRQ grant on maternal quality indicators. I was a member of the AMA PCPI, where they looked at perinatal measures. I'm also a member of the California Maternal Care Quality Collaborative, which I believe put forth the healthy newborn measure. And I'm a member of ACOG and have been involved in a lot of their activities, as well as on the board of directors of the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine.
Hi, I'm Jochen Profit. I'm a neonatologist at Texas Children's Hospital, Baylor College of Medicine. I have a NICHD grant to develop a composite indicator of neonatal intensive care quality. I am a consultant for the Vermont-Oxford Network's most recent quality improvement collaborative, which looks at improving value of quality of care, and especially improvements of quality of care, so whether quality of care results in value savings or higher costs. I am a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Technical Advisory Committee for Neonatal Quality Measures. The composite measure that I'm working on for NICHD includes several measures from the California Perinatal Quality Care Collaborative, which are largely identical with those of the Vermont-Oxford Network, and there are several measures before us that are part of that. Some of the work has been published already.
I'm Craig Gillum. I'm an infection preventionist at Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas. As far as disclosures, I'm on the Speakers Bureau for CareFusion and for Johnson & Johnson Ethicon.
I'm Bill Callahan. I'm obstetrician, gynecologist, and preventive medicine specialist working in the Division of Reproductive Health at the CDC. I also serve as CDC liaison to ACOG's Committee on Obstetric Practice. There is one measure here, proposed measure, that was proposed by CDC. I was not involved in the development of that measure. It was developed in another part of CDC outside of my division, outside of my center.
Hi, I'm Andrea Gelzer, and I'm Corporate Chief Medical Officer of the AmeriHealth Mercy family of companies. We do Medicaid managed care, and I'm an internist by training. I'm a fellow of the American College of Physicians. I have been a previous board member of a chapter of March of Dimes, and I serve on their public policy council. And I've also participated in several PCPI committee measure development activities, none related to this group. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mamrambad Jali. You can call me Jali. I'm a neonatologist, and I work at UT Southwestern Medical Center. I'm the medical director for one of the neonatal intensive care units at Parkland over there. No disclosures.
Hi, good morning. I'm Scott Burns. I'm Senior Vice President of Chapter Programs at the March of Dimes National Office. I'm a pediatrician by training, also a pediatric emergency physician. I'm also on a voluntary faculty at Brown University, where I'm a clinical professor. As far as disclosures, I work at the March of Dimes. We're in the midst of a national prematurity campaign, and my responsibility is to help our chapters, basically our state-based chapters around the country, implement programs to improve the health of moms and babies, which include partnerships with hospitals to initiate quality improvement programs, particularly to help eliminate elective deliveries before 39 weeks. And we're actually embarking this quarter on selling a service package to hospitals to help them implement those initiatives. And I wanted to make sure that I disclosed that as well.
I'm Terry Keene. I'm from Intermountain Healthcare. And I'm on the board of directors for the March of Dimes in Utah, so I also have a significant interest in the initiatives they're putting forth as a 39-week induction. And other than that, I have no disclosures.
I'm Jenny Brandenburg from Decatur Memorial Hospital in Illinois. I'm the Director of Women and Children's Services. The only thing I have to disclose is I have done a number of speaking engagements for the March of Dimes and A1 as well on eliminating the elective deliveries less than 39 weeks, and I'm the project lead sponsor for, we're part of the Big Five in Illinois for eliminating the elective deliveries less than 39 weeks.
I'm Sharon Sutherland. I don't represent the Cleveland Clinic. I'm an OBGYN there, and I'm in the quality improvement office, and I oversee maternity quality at 6 community hospitals.
I'm Barbara Kelly. I'm a family physician at the University of Colorado, medical director in a family medicine residency program, and perform maternity care. I have no disclosures.
How about that? Good morning again. I'm Mary Leslie. I'm a certified nurse midwife. I'm currently on faculty at George Washington University School of Nursing. My participation with NQF in the past, I was on the Consumer Council in 2008 during the last measure round. And my only disclosure, I think, is that formerly from Yale University and was there during the Adverse Outcome Index work that they were doing, which is a little relevant to today. And I don't think I have any other disclosures.
Good morning. My name is Rob Watson, and I'm an actively practicing obstetrician gynecologist. And I also am a physician executive for the Baylor Healthcare System in Dallas-Fort Worth. My role is primarily overseeing perinatal quality for about 8 or 9 different hospitals. And I don't believe I have any disclosures.
Good morning. I'm Lee Partridge, Senior Health Policy Advisor at the National Partnership for Women and Families here in Washington, D.C., and I am not a clinician. Instead, much of my role is devoted to promoting the use of measures once they are endorsed by the NQF process, and I've been particularly working recently in conjunction with the March of Dimes and Childbirth Connection and several others to promote the use of the elective deliveries measure prior to 39 weeks, and it seems as though it's working.
I'm Kate Chanock from the Pacific Business Group on Health. I have participated in other PCPI and AAOS committees about orthopedic surgery measures, but they're not related to this, so I have no disclosures related to this.
Thanks. I'm Chuck Dank. I'm from the Department of Health and Senior Services in New Jersey. I'm also not a clinician, never delivered a baby, never even been visited by a drug rep. What I am responsible for is measurements about quality and community health, and I'm responsible for report cards on breastfeeding and cesarean delivery and community needs assessment kind of analysis. So I'm that kind of statistician, and I'm addicted to administrative data sets, sorry. The disclosures, my background is in sociology. Disclosures, I work, I'm on the leadership of New Jersey's Perinatal Collaborative, and I speak at conferences there for them all the time, but I represent the state of New Jersey, and so nobody else. And I also work a little bit with the March of Dimes chapter in New Jersey and have been involved in the 39-week initiative and pushing it out to clinicians in that state. And I work with other community groups, too, as a speaker and sometimes providing data. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Dry. I am a general pediatrician by training, but I spend most of my time now developing quality measures, but for the other end of the age spectrum, mostly for Medicare recipients, working at the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation at Yale, New Haven Hospital and Yale Medical School. And I'm funded by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to do that work, but none of those, we've developed many measures, all outcomes measures that have come through NQF or in front of NQF right now, but there is no overlap with the group we're looking at today.
Good morning. I'm Janet Young. I'm an emergency physician at Carilion Medical Systems in Roanoke, Virginia. I am a core faculty at Virginia Tech Carilion Medical School and also the Department of Emergency Medicine residency program. I have very few disclosures except that I am an international and national speaker for gynecologic emergencies, and I've been funded to do that for the last several years. I do not currently have any speaking engagements from paid by anybody present at March of Dimes, Drug Reps, other. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Lowe, and I'm professor and chair of the Division of Women, Children, and Family Health in the College of Nursing at the University of Colorado. And I, in terms of disclosures, I serve on the board of directors on the Nursing Alliance for Quality Care. I also have an ongoing consulting contract with AWON, which is to serve as editor-in-chief of JOGIN, which is the Journal of Obstetric, Gynecologic, and Neonatal Nursing. And I have been co-I on ARC-funded projects to study training for obstetrical emergencies in rural and critical access hospitals in the Pacific Northwest.
I'm Kathleen Simpson. I'm a perinatal clinical specialist in St. Louis, Missouri at Mercy Hospital. I participated on this NQF committee that previously developed the measures, some of which we'll be looking at again today. I'm the chair of the National Advisory Council for the March of Dimes, which is also promoting the 39 weeks elimination of, you know, elective births before 39 weeks. I'm the co-chair of the A1 Patient Safety Committee, and we've been looking at patient safety measures, and I am the PI of the Michigan Keystone Obstetric Safety Project, and I just wanted to disclose that as well, where we have 77 hospitals in Michigan, and we're using some of these measures to evaluate care.
Good morning. I'm Joanne Armstrong. I'm an obstetrician. I'm the Director of Women's Health for Aetna, a large national health insurance plan. And I'm also a part-time in part-time clinical practice at Baylor College of Medicine. Most of my work at Aetna is trying to drive some of these quality efforts, including 39 weeks, which was mentioned here before. I also work on the edges of pay-for-performance activity, trying to take some best practices and translate those into contracts. I don't have anything to disclose.
I'm Bill Grobman, perinatologist from Northwestern University. In terms of disclosures, I'm on the board of Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. I'm a member of ACOG and the Practice Bulletin Committee. And as Dr. Baylor said, I'm on a project with her looking at development of quality indicators.
Are there any community members on the phone? No. Okay, thank you for those disclosures. Do any of you have anything you would like to discuss with each other, or do you have any questions of me based upon the disclosures that have been made this morning? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Anne, very much. Well, that's an impressive group of people. Thank you all for taking time out of your clearly very busy lives to come work with us for these 2 days. I'm going to take the opportunity now to just do a little bit of introduction. I'd like this to be informal, so if you have any questions, don't hesitate to jump in. Once we're finished with that, it's time to get to work, and we'll start looking at measures very shortly. Next one. Reminder that the purpose of this entire project is to look at NQF portfolio of measures for perinatal and reproductive health care. Some new measures have been submitted. Majority, however, are the 20 NQF-endorsed measures that are due for maintenance review. Most of those measures were endorsed 3 years ago. A lot has changed in the world in 3 years, and so it's important that we look at those measures
through all of the same standard criteria that we evaluate all measures. Lots of things change in evidence, lots of things change in experience, and as people have gain experience with use of these measures in the field, certainly feedback with potential logistic problems, unintended consequences, and all of those are important areas for us to explore to be sure that the measures do retain good, robust utility out in the field. Go ahead next. Just to recall, on our orientation call, we talked about how the work of NQF is grounded in support of the Department of Health and Human Services National Quality Strategy and the AIMS patient-centeredness, family engagement, I think is something that we're all very familiar with in obstetrical care, quality care for patients of all ages, which I think a lot of these measures address, elimination of disparities and alignment of public and private sectors. So affordable care, we do have some measures that are address appropriate use, certainly quality of care at various processes for mother and baby. So the work that we are doing is very much supportive of this national quality enterprise. Our tasks today, essentially, is to evaluate these submitted measures against NQF's measure evaluation criteria. Over the last few weeks in preparation for this meeting, the committee has had the opportunity to become familiar with the criteria through your orientation conference calls, the tutorial conference calls on the measure evaluation criteria, and then the four work group calls where the preliminary reviews were discussed. So hopefully everybody's had the opportunity to become very familiar with the evaluation criteria. As a result of the work group calls that were held several weeks ago, measure developers have responded to some of the discussion points and the questions that you presented. As a result, we've had some juggling of the submissions for the measures. In fact, one measure's been withdrawn, two pairs have been combined into single measures, and so it's really hard to keep the math up to date on these. So when somebody asks me how many measures, it's a little hard. So just also within NQF's portfolio of measures, there were 10 endorsed measures from prior efforts that were not resubmitted by the developers for continued endorsement. And so just to be aware that those measures will drop from our portfolio at the end of this project. So, go ahead. All right. What we're going to do today to evaluate the measures using our evaluation criteria, we have collated all of the preliminary reviews and discussion points by the work groups. We've created slides. We've shared those with you prior to the meeting, but we will be projecting them up on the screen. Each of the measures has an assigned lead discussant, and that lead discussant will lead discussion of the measure through the criteria. We'll go in order through the main criteria, importance first, scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility. There have been, as I said, responses and modifications. And how we're going to do this is, as we discuss each of the main criteria, first importance, all discussion points, and then the committee as a group will vote on those criteria. We'll talk in a minute about how you're going to do those votes. At the end of the assessment of the four main criteria, there will be a vote on whether the measure meets criteria for endorsement. All right? This is sort of the first preliminary assessment for the measure. Then we do have a measure tomorrow on that is a composite measure that has 10 component measures, so that will be a somewhat different analysis as we look at the components, as though they are not presented for individual endorsement, just the overall composite. Then the last thing we'll address are the related and competing measures. Those measures that are very similar, identified by the work group, particularly measures around hospital-acquired infections. We will look at them side by side and try to determine if all of the measures are meet the criteria, whether all some perhaps are better than others, are they all needed, do they add having all of them or only some of them add value to the portfolio. Once all of those discussions have taken place, then your recommendations become final. And we are hoping that having gone through the work groups and everybody having a lot of good preliminary discussion and evaluation of the measures, that the votes and discussions we have today will pretty much get us to the point that we have a good set of final recommendations when we finish tomorrow. So that is our plan. Anybody have any questions? about what we're going to do? Okay, we'll walk you through the first couple ones. It'll sort of get pretty obvious once we get rolling. Okay, in terms of voting, now, each of you were handed a little keypad, okay? And it's important that you keep your keypad. It is assigned to you. They aren't assigned numerically, all right? And we keep a roster of them with the voting results spreadsheet that we get out of this voting tool. If we had to, it would take some tedious work. We could go back in and figure out who voted what. Most of the time, we don't have any interest in doing that. But if it were to be if it were needed, we could. So it's important that you maintain the keypad you were assigned and not switch them or, you know, change them. The keypad is automatically on. We start off with a 60-second timer to cast the vote. You press the number that corresponds with the voting slide, which will be on the smaller screen when we do it. And then once everybody has cast their vote, Gene will, conclude it, and the results will come up on the screen. Okay? So we're going to give it a couple of tests. Gene, do you have yours up there? Okay. So your first voting exercise. Here's the question. Did you have any difficulty traveling to Washington, D.C.? Everybody, you can just press it. Gene, go ahead and get started. Now go ahead and press. I can't see how many have responded. There should be 26 of you. You don't need to press in, just as long as you press it. If there's any question, you can press it again. Not really. Okay, Gene, go ahead and close it down. Close it. There you go. Okay? So this is what we will do for each of the voting opportunities. Want to try it again, or you feel comfortable, you're good with it? I think we're good with it. Okay. And there are 23 votes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There should be 26. We'll see if we can figure that one out. Okay. All right. Just a couple of issues I wanted to raise to you. We've talked probably around the edges of these in some of these preliminary discussions. But again, just to emphasize, we do want to think about disparities in terms of these measures. Are the measures able to provide information about disparities of care around that particular topic or process of care? And how has the measure been developed to address disparities? It is an important priority for N2F and HHS. Also, we're in the several-year conversion to ICD-10 codes. Everybody's really excited about that. Some folks are farther ahead of the game than others. We had submitted ICD-9 to ICD-10 conversion codes. We're certainly going to be asking the measure developers what their status is, because hopefully, very shortly, we will have conversion codes from everyone. The other issue is harmonization. Harmonization is the concept of defining and coding the same concept in the same way. I think for those of you in the field, the idea of harmonization comes home most apparently when you're trying to implement two measures that define the same term slightly differently, and it drives everybody crazy. So some of the biggest feedback we get from the field is, if you're going to give us more measures, make sure they're all defined the same way. Harmonization is truly a critical thing. So when you see elements of harmonization issues or concerns, particularly a lot of you have experience with the measures, be sure and bring them up. They are important discussion points as we go forward. Any questions on those? Okay. The last one, I think, is just as we discuss the measures, we've got 39 measures in our portfolio. 20 of them are under review. 10 are not being resubmitted. We have given you a list of all the measures in the portfolio. There are 9 measures that you are not up for maintenance review because they were endorsed within the last, I think, 18 months. And so it's a little too soon. But for you to get a big picture of the whole portfolio, we have provided that list for you. So frequently during discussion, you will say, gee, it would be really great if we had a measure do this, or this measure is okay, but it would be great if it did something else or more, or has some other characteristic. So we will be capturing those suggestions and ideas into a set of maybe the recommendations or wish list, if you will, of measures that we would like to see. Also, we know that there are measures in the development pipeline, particularly the measures that some of you have worked with PCPI, and when those measures are available and fully developed and tested, we will come up with an opportunity to bring them into NQF for evaluation for endorsement. So with that, are there any questions from anybody? Okay. Lee, go ahead.
I probably should have said this one slide back, Riva, but how much weight do you want to encourage us to put on whether or not a measure is now or could easily be suitable for electronic measurement? I raise this because in some other committees that I serve on, there's a lot of pressure to move toward e-measures.
Yeah. Under feasibility, I think we've talked about it in a lot of the work groups, the amenability of the measure for use in electronic health records. I think it's an important feasibility sub-criteria, and it's come up in discussion. So, again, none of these are absolutes. That's why we've got a group of people, and you're all going to sort of offer your opinions for a collective conclusion. So I think it's an important thing because certainly there's a lot of movement and a lot of emphasis on use of electronic health records, and we want measures that certainly can be used there. So I think it's an important criteria. Again, there's no one single sub-criteria that's going to sway the day for any single measure, but I think it's an important thing for important consideration, as members of the work group have brought up during the preliminary discussion.
Can I comment on that, Riva?
Yeah.
Do you mind? I had the opportunity a couple of summers ago to sit on a state working group with the National Center for Health Statistics task force to sort of create functional profiles and definitions for transfer of data between electronic hospital-based record systems and vital record systems. And that time track is still a long way off. The standards just to get things into vital records, you know, which is a thing of great concern to me, get, you know, a medical record transcribed automatically and submitted to the state as opposed to being done manually. We're still probably 3, 4, 5 years away from that. And after that comes the public health profiles where data is transferred from hospital-based medical records to other public health uses, you know, which are reportable events and so on and so forth. So considering that this activity happens every 3 to 5 years, is that the usual thing for these maintenance?
Every 3 years.
Yeah. So it'll probably come up again as closer to being reality at the next cycle.
Mary, I think you had a question.
Yes, I have a question regarding the composite measures. In the guides about evaluating composite measures, it lists both different and additional criteria, but the form submitted by the developers is basically the current or the older form, which doesn't really provide answers to those criteria. Are we going to get that information?
We're going to talk about the evaluating the composite a little bit more before we do that tomorrow. Okay.
So as somebody who's preparing that, we don't have all the information.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll check that. Okay. With all the preliminaries out of the way, I'm going to turn things over to our co-chairs, to Carol and Laura, and it's time to get to work.
Great. So first up, we're going to look at 475, which is administration of a Hep B vaccine to newborns before facility discharge, and we'll start with Terry. Thank you. So beginning, we're going to look at importance, questions of impact, opportunity for improvement, and evidence. Thanks.
Do you want me to read it out loud, or what do you want me to do?
You could, in your own words, just cover those areas, and then we'll open it up for comments that people may have and then vote. So it's a fairly structured process to go through all four criteria.
All right. Initially, I'll just go over the exactly what this is. It's put forth by the CDC. It's the percent of live newborns that receive the hepatitis B vaccine prior to discharge from the birthing facility. The numerator is the number that received the vaccine, and the denominator is the number of live newborns born at the birthing facility during the calendar year. There is a possibility of exclusions once the ICD-10s come in if parents choose not to give the newborn their immunization. It's a process measure. Again, a bit of a summary. HBV causes acute infection and chronic infections. Women with high viral loads transmit 90% to their infants, and most of the morbidity and mortality occurs among infants who develop chronic infection. Approximately 90% will develop chronic, and about 25% of these infants will have premature death from complications of the chronic infection. As we looked at this as a work group, our importance to measure and report, three of us felt it was a high impact, two moderate, felt the opportunity, again, for improvement, high three, moderate two, and we all felt it did meet importance. Some of the rationales for wondering was a high impact or a moderate. We were wondering if the case incidence of hepatitis B was decreasing, and we were wondering what percent gets the entire series. We're really measuring the initial impact. Without vaccination and the globulin, 6,000 to 9,000 of these infants would become chronically infected with HBV, and approximately 25-50 would be expected to die of chronic liver disease. The primary goal of getting this started at birth is to prevent the chronic HBV infection when the risk is highest at birth through 5 years. So, do you want me to keep going here, or how do you want to go forward with this?
Are you finished with your comments about importance to measure?
I am right now, yeah. Okay. I don't know how much you want me to go
through. Sure. Well, I think now we can open it up to see if any members of the steering committee have comments on those issues. Okay.
I guess the question I would ask is, it seems to me from the work group, was the whole question of impact was really, I think, the cornerstone of the conversation. A relatively small number, the incidence seems to be decreasing. So the opportunity to drive further improvement seemed to be the discussion point.
You give us comments.
Okay. Yeah, and we have our developers here for consultation, so thank you.
Are you around to over there?
Hey, Tanya?
Trudy.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. There is actually an increasing number of women who are hepatitis B surface antigen positive, delivering women in the U.S., and this is primarily from people who are immigrants and refugees, many of whom may not be in the system. So I don't think we can say, although overall hepatitis B infections in the U.S., the acute infections are decreasing, the number of women delivering babies has actually increased and is estimated now to be around 25,000 a year.
Okay, if there are no other comments, I think we can all vote on the question of importance.
Let's wait till Jean gets it up on the screen. Yeah, Regine. Yeah. You're voting for on just the importance of measure and report criteria. It's not a matter of concurring with the subgroup, it's a matter of having heard all that input, how do you rate the measure on that criterion?
So one would be saying that you agree that it meets the criteria.
The results are yes 22, no 2.
Okay, so let's move on to scientific acceptability, which is reliability and validity.
All right. The number of newborn infants again. The reliability is available within pharmacy records, vaccine, medication administration. A lot of this is manual abstraction right now, which is an issue. Difficulty because there is no ICD-9 code with the parental refuser. Refusal is common for parents to refuse a vaccine, especially when the mother is not infected. It's difficult to look at for public reporting if there are differences in the populations for refusal rates. Our group felt high 3, moderate 2, and as far as the validity, high 3, moderate 2. Again, our concerns were there are some disparities. It's difficult to tell if the disparities are due to the populations or if it's due to refusal rates from the parents.
Right. When we submitted the proposal, we submitted it as an overall measure that would not have included refusals. And we were asked by NQF to include refusals in the measure. Because currently there are not data available in every hospital to account for refusals, we proposed two ways of reporting the measure. One, an overall coverage, hepatitis B, vaccine coverage at birth, and the other, a measure that we would hope would improve or increase over time, would be one that included refusals as that information becomes available.
Which one are you intending to be endorsed?
Well, we would hope that both would be endorsed, but certainly the overall would be the most critical to be endorsed.
Could I just ask about that, the overall being the most critical? Because it does seem that if it's really like the underlying quality that you're trying to get at, that patient refusals, if it's apparent that there's no way to overcome that if we're honoring autonomy. And so why is that the more important one to endorse than the patient refusal? In fact, it seems like it would be key to have patient refusals in there.
Right, and your question is really pertinent, and it depends on the perspective. So if it's from the public health perspective of preventing disease, the overall coverage would be the most important. But if it's from the perspective of autonomy of the parents into making a decision for their child, then, of course, the refusal would be the more important.
So I guess my question would be, is it, because, and this might be the lack of my understanding of the sort of the design of these measures, but it seems like it's a very different thing if it's sort of a public health sense that we're trying to get, which I totally see is really important, versus a quality indicator for a hospital, institution, or provider, which it seems to me hard to hold them accountable if their population, let's say they took care of a very particular population, jointly, you know, and fully refused to accept the vaccine, and it would look like they were providing low quality care if we were using it as a quality indicator, when in fact they weren't. In fact, from some perspective, if you look at quality as, you know, autonomy, they would be high quality care. So I guess I would advocate that refusals be the key measure, or included in the key measure.
Well, we're not arguing that refusal should be excluded. We're saying that that is an alternative, or let's say an ancillary measure that could be added as the information becomes available. But I guess from a public health perspective, we might say that the quality measure really is in helping parents to understand what the implications are of not giving the vaccine and making sure that all infants receive the vaccine before discharge from the hospital. So that really is quality. Did the infant get protected before leaving the hospital?
This is an advisory committee on immunization practices recommendation, is it not?
It is.
It is.
And so I would not think that the measure isn't valid if you don't include the refusals, and folks will be, you know, measured side by side. So I would advocate strongly also that the refusals be included in the denominator.
Right, and it was simply a practical issue, because not all facilities that in our feasibility study, not all facilities had the information available to put in the refusals. So we felt at the beginning that the overall coverage plus refusals when the information is available, the refusals make the numbers look better, the coverage rates look better. So it would be in the interest of the hospital to develop methods for being able to report refusals. So we're not against doing that, but it's simply that not all hospitals have the capability of doing that at this time. They do have the capability of doing the overall measure.
Yes. So I'm assuming this isn't the first time this has come up in an immunization rate measure, and I'm wondering if there are examples of NHS-endorsed measures of how refusals have been handled.
You're right.
Okay. You're right. Refusals are always an issue because that's just a difficult data element and it's challenging. I don't think there's a standard yet, though I think around the criteria of and so the priority of partnering with the patients and the patient and parent engagement, you certainly need to balance those with perhaps the public health issues. So there isn't a standard way of doing it. So I think at this point, you all can see what you think is the most important at this point in time. Yeah, there isn't really a standard.
Jennifer?
Yes.
Rob?
I assume that there are probably regional differences in the refusal rate, but do we have any kind of an idea about a national? Are we talking a 0.5% or a 20% refusal rate? Does anybody have any idea?
For hepatitis B, I do not have any information, but overall it's less than 3%. There are parts of the country, pockets of the country, where it's considerably higher in the 10%, maybe even 12% range, but overall it's quite low, less than 3%.
Jennifer?
I just have a practical question. I'm not so familiar with ICD-10. Does anybody know if there's a refusal code in ICD-10?
There are several. There are several, but maybe not as specific as we might like, but at least the direction is that to include those codes.
So the possibility exists that when ICD-10 is implemented, the refusal issue goes away because you won't have to hand-fix through that data, that it should be available?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but certainly that's the potential.
Comment about the ICD-9 coding for refusal. You said it wasn't specific. What
not specific is it? No, I'm not familiar that ICD-9 coding has any coding for refusal. For 10, yes, it's in your information, the codes that are for refusal, and I can look for it. And 2A1A8. Under the denominator exclusion, not carried out because of immune compromise, not carried out because of patient allergy, patient decision for reasons of belief or group pressure, not carried out because of patient decision for unspecified reason, not carried out because of patient refusal, patient decision for other reason, not carried out because of caregiver refusal. Those are current codes. Okay.
So we had a question. I need to encourage us to wrap this up because we have 5 more minutes and 2 more topic areas to deal with.
I just wanted to volunteer the information that I have served for a number of years on the American Academy of Pediatrics Medical Home Advisory Panel, and in the course of most recent discussions of our face-to-face meeting this year, the subject of parent refusals on vaccines came up repeatedly among the pediatricians, and they recognize that it's pushing their quality scores in the wrong direction, but they also recognize that they feel they have a role in educating the parents. Now, it's a little harder in the discharge situation, but certainly the doctors that I've spent a lot of time with take this very seriously as part of their job.
Okay. Yeah, Nancy quickly, and then maybe we'll need to do the vote.
It was just a question. Is it appropriate for us to vote on whether it is the patient refusal is in the denominator or not?
If you read.
If you read the specifications that are presented, it includes those exclusions. Now, we've certainly seen measures where not everybody could implement them today because of data sources or availability or all sorts of logistical reasons. However, that does not preclude you from recommending the measure. Certainly, as measures gain use and adoption, they figure out how to collect the data. So I think that in this particular question, you've got denominator exclusions optional. Now, optional, it causes a bit of a problem when you're trying to standardize things. And some choose to, you know, select the option versus not select the option. So I think that in this particular case, you may choose to leave it open-ended like that. However, you may choose to recommend the measure only by including the exclusions. That's within your decision making.
Yeah, could I make a motion then that we approve the denominator with the exclusion in it of refusal so that the measure becomes, the denominator becomes with the exclusion.
Second for that?
I will second.
Can I just clarify, do you mean exclusively? So, not sorry to use that word, but basically the measure would only be approved for use with the exclusion.
Right.
And so I think just approving the overall.
Chuck's previous point that we have a system in transition, so this is for now, is also well taken. So can we, do we have the capability to jump into a vote for that?
Well, remember what you're doing is voting on whether the measure as specified, and you've specified it to remove the option, to include the exclusions. You're voting on that. Does that meet the criteria of scientific acceptability of the measure properties?
Sorry, can I clarify further? This to me feels like a vote, I just want to be clear, that would be a vote against reporting the measure without the exclusion. Can that be separate from a final vote?
On the vote?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
It sounds like you guys should take two votes.
Mm-hmm. I think there's two separate questions. One, do we want to, we're treating it as two different measures, basically, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Sure. You can do that. No, you'll just go back and repeat it.
Okay.
Just to clarify, Reva, there's no more option for a time-limited endorsement because
right.
This would seem like a great measure to get a little more information on for a couple of years.
A couple of things. No, there is no more opportunity for time-limited endorsement. This measure was granted time-limited endorsement 3 years ago, and the new information is what you have in front of you. So I think what we'll need to do is take two votes on scientific acceptability. The first one will be as presented in this document where it's optional. All right, so might be an overall rate, might include refusals or not. Is that clear? Is everybody ready to vote on that? All right, Jean, go ahead.
Everybody's hit it a couple of times, I'm sure it registers. Okay, let's see what...
11 yes and 13 no on scientific acceptability for the measure as written. Now you want to re-vote for the measure where the optional exclusions part is eliminated and it's, you know, with the exclusions for parental refusal. Is that correct?
I think this is really becomes very complicated because the decision we make right now has consequences on all the other measure criteria like feasibility and usability.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have to vote on all of these twice. I'm a little worried this is going to get really confusing.
All right.
Because right, you know, because a measure, an overall measure will be a lot more feasible than a measure where everybody has to go dig into ICD-10 codes. So I just caution and like, I feel like this is getting confusing.
If the vote you've just taken is the one you want to stick with for this measure, we're finished with this measure. Because it did not pass scientific acceptability. If that's what you'd like, that's fine.
I think we should vote. We take the next vote.
Okay.
This is a vote on the scientific acceptability of the measure where the exclusions for patient-parent refusal are not optional but are part of the measure specifications, correct? All right, Jean's got to get us up there. What's the matter?
Do it again. You can go back. Yes, but each other needs to do that. Come on, Jane. You're supposed to know how to do this.
Could you comment on the reliability of extracting the refusal codes from the chart?
Again, the reliability was the term, well, again, it's a little bit confusing the way the reliability versus validity was interpreted in the any instructions when the feasibility study was done. So validity was determined by chart review and estimates from chart review. So without the ICD-10 codes, it would depend on each hospital system for determining that information. Okay. And in a given institution that is not using ICD-10 codes using the same system, it should be very reliable from one year to the next. However, across institutions, it would not be as reliable without using ICD-10 codes.
And are there any studies, you know, looking at what the drug review you know, might yield as compared to then going back to the parents maybe and checking with them whether they truly refused or not?
No, they're not. No, the chart reviews did look to see whether the parents had refused. Okay, so that from that standpoint, there was some reliability estimate.
Okay, so can we have a vote now on keeping parental refusals in the denominator? Not ready. All right.
So is everybody on your vote? How many votes? I can't. Everybody push that button.
Push it again.
Yeah, push it again.
There's
something here that I
have. Okay, scroll through the list.
How many? How many
yes?
How many no's?
They can't. This is in the moderate scale, the high
moderate. Why don't we do it by hand? That way we'll know. We lost
Jennifer.
All
right, we'll go ahead anyway.
So, Reba, for the sake of time, yeah. Dr. Poppet alluded to this, but actually was specific about it. This is sort of moot, isn't it? Because you already said we can't move forward with the measure as written. So even if we vote yes here, I mean, there, I already had feasibility questions without the exclusions in the denominator. So I don't understand where we're going to be going with this.
Well, essentially what you're doing is giving a conditional recommendation. You believe it meets the scientific acceptability criteria conditional on the exclusions being non-optional. So, I mean, since they're in there, you're not really changing anything. What you're doing is taking just the optional out and saying that as far that your opinion is the measure needs to maintain those exclusions.
But I guess, again, I'm new at this as well, but it affects the usability and feasibility assessment, so.
So we'll come to those.
Okay.
Quickly.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready, Jean? It looks like,
Can we get a hand, or? We're not ready. Okay, let's do it by hand. How many, for the measure that is, take the option out, the exclusions are a mandatory part of the measure. Who feels it meets the criteria of scientific acceptability?
Do you want no for the record?
Yes.
Yes, no's for the record. Okay, thank you. So now we will move on to usability, which is internal quality improvement and external public reporting.
All right. Currently, it's not being used in public reporting, although the National Immunization Survey does currently produce hepatitis B birth dose rates. And again, our concern was how we capture and report patients who refuse with contraindications, and as this last discussion brought up, there is no way right now to capture it accurately, validly. Is it even useful without it? There's a big question that we brought up in our use group. Again, the suitability, we felt it seems to be a largely solved problem, although you mentioned that, especially in the minorities, and while it meets criteria, we had questions regarding implementation and hospital capacity to report the measure. ICD-10s, again, was our big issue with right now until ICD-10s come in, and they're wondering if the value had decreased over time as we're moving forward.
Comments on usability? Jennifer?
So when we do these kinds of things at our hospital, you look at the patients who didn't get it, which already whittles down the number greatly, and you do it by hand. We're talking about handfuls, except in the largest hospital systems, or in these pockets. So I think nationally this is doable. It's a little more work intensive than if ICD-10 is implemented, but I still think that this is feasible, at least in the interim time until ICD-10 comes along.
Anything else on usability? Okay, what? Can we take a vote then?
Yeah, are we okay?
So just clarification, are we voting on the measure as written now, or the with the...
Yeah, excuse me, the developer wants to make a comment. In terms of usability, currently the National Perinatal Hepatitis B Coordinators, once every 5 years, review the charts, and 90% of the hospitals that birth or deliver 90% of infants, that the resources to continue doing that will not be continuing. It simply will not. And this quality measure would be a way for hospitals to look at their own outcomes as well as help the coordinators identify hospitals or birthing centers that do need some help with how they can facilitate getting the birth done. So I think there's a great value to public reporting of this measure. I would strongly urge your support for it.
Okay. Let's vote then on usability.
This, the rating scale is high, moderate, low, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 4 is insufficient information.
I apologize, I just need clarification. Are we voting on the measure as written or with this amendment that we... What are we voting on here?
I think you'll have to be voting on the one that you, the conditional
one
that was approved. Okay. All right. High 4, moderate 14, low 6.
So now, finally, we have feasibility, which would be things like errors, unintended consequences, and burden to report. Here, any comments?
Someone who actually pays for the person to pull it out, I'm really concerned with now the way we've got it written with the exclusions, that it's going to be very costly for someone to pull out, go through all the charts to find the family refusal piece. That's a big concern with the feasibility for it for me.
Other comments?
I think I'd like to second that. I think, like, as the day progresses, maybe this is because this is the very first measure that we chose, and so I wonder whether there's like a harsher, there's going to be like maybe like a harsher, you know, cutoff for this level than maybe for others. But I think we have to be careful about entering a Faustian bargain about wanting every single possible thing that would make a measure as valid as could possibly be, and then trading that off for, you know, for feasibility.
Trudy.
Yes, in the feasibility study for those that did look at exclusions, the cost was actually relatively low for those who had the information, even if it was on the paper form. I think the advantage to having eventually going to electronic systems and having this a measure in place would be that it can be programmed in to the electronic medical records as people go forward. The highest cost was for the programming initially. So people who had paper systems were usually the smaller facilities, and the cost was relatively low.
Other comments? Okay, let's take a vote, please, on feasibility. And again, it's going to be the scale from high to insufficient.
Three high, 19 moderate, 3 low.
Okay, now there's one more vote for this measure, and then we'll be moving on. And that is, overall, is it your view that this measure meets the clearly demarcated NQF criteria for endorsement?
Yes. As amended.
How many? Push it again. Everybody push the number again.
How many touches them that work? I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
22 yes, 3 no.
Okay, so we'll be recommending that this measure be endorsed.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to move on to 582, which is avoidance of oral hypoglycemic agents with diabetes and pregnancy. Do we have a developer here who can join us on this or on the phone? Okay, great. And this is Barbara Kelly. So we'll begin with importance to measure.
So our our group discussed this at length, and this measure initially is identifying pregnant women with diabetes, not gestational diabetes, but pre-existing diabetes, who are not taking an oral hypoglycemic agent. And the denominator was pregnant women with a diagnosis of non-gestational diabetes, and the numerator was those not taking a hypoglycemic agent. And we discussed a few things. One was the performance gap did not seem to be huge. The numbers we got were between 81 and 100% in terms of the reported measures to us. The other issue raised was that it was not taking an oral hypoglycemic agent, but it wasn't that they were on insulin or that they were well controlled. So this is a process measure and not a clinical outcome measure. And the biggest debate within our work group was that there's increasing use of oral hypoglycemics for these women, including metformin and glyburide, and that this measure may not meet the importance criteria. I have to admit that my vote initially was the one that said yes for meets importance, and after the conversation in the work group, I moved my vote to no. So our work group actually did not take this measure any further. We voted that it did not meet the importance criteria. Now, since that time, I think the measure has been revised to take metformin and glyburide off the list of banned agents. However, I think this measure needs more work. In our opinion, it did not meet the importance criteria, so we actually did not go further to discuss any of the rest. So I guess I'll leave it open for discussion or answer questions.
Can you have comments from the measure developer about the interim proposals?
Sure, yeah. We updated the guidelines to the most recent study in 2011, which does reiterate some of the concerns that were said on the work group call, that although insulin is the preferred treatment approach, metformin and glyburide have been shown to be effective alternatives and without adverse effects in some women. So essentially, we took glyburide and metformin out of the numerator, basically saying if a woman's on those medications, it's okay. But beyond that, we thought that it was representative or in line with the guidelines. And those are the things that we need, and we wanted to hear what your intent was.
Do you have any data on what happens when you make that change?
No. Do you mean like running the percentages and finding out what the compliance is?
Yes.
Taking those off the table?
Yes.
No.
So it sounds like that measure then hasn't been tested before. This new measure that you this new measure that you've come up with has not actually been tested.
Not running it like that.
Right. Which we decided isn't allowed. Okay. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments?
I'd just like to go back to Barbara's comment on the 1D criteria, which is opportunity for improvement. And that was another issue and is an important sub-criteria. Any discussion from the group?
Okay. Right. Okay. Nancy?
Yeah, only that. As I reviewed the materials, there was insufficient data to even evaluate whether or not there was a performance gap.
Okay. Any other comments? So I think we can vote on the question of importance to measure and report, whether it meets the criteria for impact, high impact, opportunity for improvement, and evidence altogether.
Yes,
1, no, 24.
Okay, so according to the guidelines, that means that this measure will not go forward in our process, and we'll move on to the next measure. Yeah. Which is? Yes?
And I apologize, I was on a different time zone and didn't realize my timing in joining this committee meeting on behalf of Dr. Stephen Clark. And I just wanted to make sure that the measure 473 improving DT prophylaxis, has that been opined on yet?
We're just getting to it, thank you.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Glad you could be here. So this is 473, appropriate DVT prophylaxis in women with cesareans, and it's a Hospital Corporation of America measure, and Bill is going to lead the discussion.
So in terms of importance, I think the sort of the discussion on the committee and the sort of the conflict, if one exists, is that it is a designed to prevent a catastrophic event, that is maternal death, from deep venous DVT, but it is an uncommon event. So in terms of just the importance, this sort of discussion that went on, and I think largely the subgroup agreed that it was important. You can see the votes up there, high 3 and moderate 4, low 1. But the moderates and lows were sort of, the discussion was just about the relative infrequency. And of course, the highs were that even, albeit infrequent, it is such a catastrophe. And if we're thinking about maternal death, that is oftentimes cited as the number one cause of maternal death. In one of Steve Clark's paper from HCA, it was certainly the number one preventable cause of maternal death in HCA series of maternal deaths. And so that's really what it's about in terms of importance to measure and report. In terms of opportunity for improvement, you know, this is a little sketchy in that it's just not, there's just not great data on what people are or not doing. I think from a sort of anecdotal perspective, the use of DVT prophylaxis is certainly not widespread for every cesarean. I think there are many institutions that still do not do it universally. And I can even speak from our institution, which is just to say that we weren't doing it universally until relatively recently. It was not a ACOG explicit recommendation, so people weren't following it for that reason. And I think we only have reason to believe that there is opportunity for improvement in the application of DVT prophylaxis during every cesarean. It's just not terribly well described. In terms of evidence, the quantity of evidence is relatively moderate to low. There just aren't that many studies about it, because it is a rare event, so really hard to do. An institution like HCA with many thousands, hundreds of thousands of births has the capacity to do it. There's just not that many studies about DVT in pregnancy and prophylaxis. It's a relatively uncommon event like we discussed. And most of the work about DVT prophylaxis, quite frankly, that's been done has been done, if an OBGYN at all, on the gynecology side and not in OB specifically. Also, it's difficult to get good data because so many of the DVTs that occur are post-discharge, oftentimes patients going to other hospitals. So it's very, very difficult to, in terms of ascertainment. So the quantity of the studies that have been done is relatively small, and as you can tell, the quality accordingly is relatively reduced as well, although what exists is consistent in that it is a, of maternal deaths that occur, it is a high on the list of causes. It is preventable largely from all data that exists in other specialties, if not in obstetrics specifically. There is some cost effectiveness data. It is a relatively low cost intervention, easy to do. And so anyway, that would be my take on the evidence, and sort of reflects what the subcommittee discussed as well. So overall, we came down that it was important to measure and report because it is the potential to drive practice that is relatively easy and could prevent a true catastrophe. And I have nothing more to opine.
I have a question. Any insight into, beyond these general limitations, talked about that, about why ACOG hasn't recommended it?
Well, they literally, a practice bulletin just came out, I don't know, 3 months ago,
so
there, yeah, where they did, and I can, yeah, so they did. So now they do, and so now I think it is a, you know, it would have been hard to hold people feet to the fire before that, but now with an explicit recommendation from ACOG, literally in the practice bulletin, that says that all pregnant women undergoing cesarean should receive DVT prophylaxis, it's kind of hard, so, you know.
Just in terms of numbers, I did see the number here for fatal PE rate in terms of a goal, in terms of reduction, and it is a relatively rare occurrence, but a catastrophic one. What about numbers in terms of the incidence or prevalence of DVTs in this scenario? Is there any...
In which scenario specifically?
You have a woman just in general, in terms of, you know, women who comes in for a C-section, or, I mean, what...
Right, so again...
Depend on their, you know, weight, does it depend, do we have any data on that? I'm asking the developer, I guess.
Yeah, so...
I can speak to some of those numbers, actually. My name is Janet Young. I'm an emergency physician, and this is a problem that we deal with on a daily basis, if not shiftly basis. So patients who come in with DVT who are currently pregnant is a relatively common issue, actually, especially in the second and third trimesters. Most patients who do present with PE do it in the postpartum period, in the first 3 to 5 days postpartum, so the emergency department oftentimes sees these patients as a first pass caregiver. It's not uncommon at all. So it's not relatively rare. I just don't think you're seeing it on the OBGYN side because those patients are coming back into the emergency department and the diagnosis is made in the ER and then they go to the ICU, oftentimes where they're not cared for by OBGYN, they're cared for by pulmonologists and critical care medicine specialists. So sometimes you're outside of that care window in changing providers from service to service, from OBGYN to critical care medicine. About 4 to 8% of patients who come in with shortness of breath in postpartum period have a PE. And unfortunately, it's not at all uncommon. So as far as your numbers for DVT, usually it's second and third trimesters, and those patients who are more overweight, have underlying comorbidities, it's just like every other health system problem. When there are additional comorbidities, your rate of DVT go up. In the postpartum period, patients who undergo C-section seem to have a higher PE rate. That's just my anecdotal experience, having done emergency medicine for 15 years. I can't give you numbers as to exactly how many C-sections versus regular normal spontaneous vaginal deliveries, But I do know that it is slightly increased, and maybe perhaps because those patients are on bed rest for a longer period of time. I don't have that data.
So, yeah, so I could speak to that. So the I think a couple things are relevant. One, of course, is that this wouldn't take care of any of the antepartum DVTs. But a significant portion, whether it's in total majority, like 50% or a third, occur sort of intra-postpartum. Cesarean section in terms of a relative risk is thought to convey about a five-fold increased risk of deep venous thrombosis. The frequency of deep venous thrombosis in the pregnant population is probably on the order of 3 per 1,000, and so if you then imagine that cesarean is a five-fold increase, you can see that, you know, maybe half of those are occurring intra to the postpartum, and cesarean increases it by fivefold, and is, I think, in some ways the most important thing, right? So it's a low-frequency event, but conceptually and easily and cheaply preventable one. And I think that is, at the end of the day, but it's not like DVTs are, yeah, there's huge ascertainment problems. They are not, in the ER or anywhere, they're not a huge frequency event, but again, they are an event that in PE causes death, and in terms of DVT, causes long-lasting morbidity like post-venous thrombosis syndrome. So,
well, you said 3 per 1,000, right?
Right, 3 per 1,000 overall. About again, ascertainment issues, and then, but yes, yeah, so 3 per 1,000, but that's not per cesarean. That's the overall obstetric population, 3/4 of which are having NSVDs. More or less.
But if there are 4 million births, that's just still a significant number.
Oh, I mean, totally.
That's a real, okay.
Yeah, it's a low per capita event, but it's a cumulative risk. Yeah, absolutely.
There are long-standing recommendations for DVT prophylaxis and gynecologic surgery, other pelvic surgery, and yet we have not done a good job in another pelvic surgery in women who also are in a hypercoagulable state. So that inconsistency has existed longstanding. And pulmonary embolus accounts for about 10% of all pregnancy-related deaths in the United States, as best as we can determine. So again, low-frequency maternal deaths is the worst thing that can happen.
Other comments on importance? Okay, I think we could take a vote then. And a yes would mean that you agree that this measure meets criteria for high impact, opportunity for improvement, and evidence. Yes, this is just members of the committee. And 3 no. Okay. So that means that we'll go on to consider scientific acceptability, validity, and reliability.
So in terms of scientific acceptability, we can start with reliability. You can see that the committee was kind of split high 3, moderate 2, and low 2. In terms of I'll just say validity at the same time, high 3, moderate 4, and low 0, the discussion that went on, you can see the bullet points up there. Essentially, the data elements were fairly straightforward. It's pretty easy to ascertain whether or not someone had compression boots on. And there was only one exclusion, which was that someone was already on pharmacologic prophylaxis for some other reason. there is confusion in the section as terminology switches to, I'm not sure what the PCD means. Pneumatic compression devices. So I think the confusion about this was, we had a long discussion about the exclusion criteria, meaning that you're already on some form of anticoagulation. If you're already on some form of pharmacologic anticoagulation, there's no compelling evidence that you require additional mechanical anticoagulation for just general run-of-the-mill cesarean. And so from a sort of a validity perspective, it makes total sense that for these rare patients who are on pharmacologic prophylaxis during their cesarean, that they need not be counted because they're already received. They don't need to get compression boots. And then there was a whole bunch of discussion about how easy this was to ascertain and how frequent this population was, and should we just throw compression boots on them anyway. And at the end of the day, I guess, well, I'm not sure we completely had agreement, but there was at least a general sense that it was okay to keep the exclusions. It was certainly most valid to keep them, although there was a remaining strain of concern regarding just the ability to extract those from the medical record. There hadn't been a great amount of reliability analysis testing, certainly widespread outside of HCA, and that's really the rest of it's about heparin versus boots. So it's really about the heparin versus the boots, and this is unlikely to cause a big problem anyway, since it is a very small number of patients who are on pharmacologic heparin at the time of their cesarean. It occurs, but uncommon. So anyway, we were generally on the side of yes.
Okay. Comments on scientific acceptability? Okay, I think we're ready to take a vote then on this.
Four yes, one no.
Okay, so we'll go on to usability then.
Usability we thought was relatively high. Basically, it's an easy to understand metric. It's easy to sort of drive practice at hospitals. It's easy to get insight in between practice and your outcome. And so, in any case, we thought usability was high, understandable. And it's easy to drive public improvement, quality improvement.
Comments? Okay, I think we can vote on usability then, please.
While we're voting, can I ask a simple question? If the measure of when we're done voting is that all 25 people have voted, that sort of removes the possibility that one will quietly abstain?
Yeah, I mean, we really have asked you here to participate, so abstaining, unless there's a really, really strong reason for it, is probably not something we want to encourage.
This measure as written, or as I read it, is only talking about at the time of delivery and or at the time of surgery. And so some of the data on especially the compression stockings is that they're supposed to be worn at least 23 hours a day, and you know, how long do you wear them until after the delivery or until discharge? I guess I'm a little concerned in terms of the scientific of this, is that the real benefit is may even be a little further downstream, and we're not really capturing that with the measure, which is knowing that at the time of surgery they have the boots on.
Right, and so and this was talked a little bit about in the committee as well, and I think I would say a couple of things. One is, again, leveraging from sort of gynecologic surgery, that because it is practically, from a usability and feasibility perspective, practically impossible to collect whether people are wearing it usefully after their operation. I mean, you can have whether it's like written for, and you can have whether the nurse, but you know, whether it's actually on their legs and it's pumped in the machine and cycling is that is pervasive throughout all the literature essentially. And so again, all of this is in the context of leveraging from gynecologic and non-gynecologic surgeries, which is that at the time of surgery is the greatest import for DVT reduction, but it is absolutely an extrapolation, admittedly.
Okay, so the vote was 18 high, 6 moderate, and 1 low. And finally, we can do feasibility, please.
So feasibility, we thought, was also, you can tell most of the committee thought it was high. The two people who did not, one thought it was moderate and one thought it was low. Generally, it's feasible. It's easy to ascertain. It's in, oftentimes, in for hospitals that have EMR, it's in the order itself. If not, it's in the written order. If not, it's easy to ascertain from what happens at the time of the surgery. It's often, you know, it's most often, it's easily documented. So that was really the rationale for most people believing it to be feasible.
Just to ask about the question Lee asked, for any of you who are using this measure, is it something that's in your electronic records at all yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, at Intermountain Healthcare, this was our board goal this year, was to do this. And what we found, we did do exactly what Bill said. We went to the bedside, and we found that only 55% of the time were the moms even wearing them, even though they were ordered and documented they were on. So we actually went to manual just bedside. So it is a hard one to actually see if you're making a difference.
This is the thing that we have at HCA. We then revisited this to our standard electronic order sets as well as our computer-based documentation systems.
Thank you. Jennifer?
Hi, I think, you know, whether the compressions are drawn in surgery is fairly easily ascertainable. It's the exceptions to the rule. So whether they're on heparin, whether they've been on heparin, but they've been off for 12 hours, whether that was appropriate or not, devil's in the details there. So while the compression booth is the easy one, it's the part about the heparin and the medicalization and those exceptions that are going to soak up the resources to ascertain. So in my mind, that lowers the feasibility of this. If this was just our compression booth on, yes or no, this would be much more feasible.
Yeah, and I think the way that the committee kind of reasoned that out was kind of what you said about the hepatitis thing, which is that the vast majority, you know, heparin use is a less than 1% event. And so for the rare time, we didn't want it to ding hospitals that might have particular high-risk populations or choose, I mean, it is an acceptable practice if you wanted to use prophylactic pharmacologic heparin instead of compression boots. I wouldn't say it's common practice, but if for whatever local reason someone wanted to do that, it certainly wouldn't be wrong or bad quality. And so if those hospitals want to go to town and delve into their medical records, but for most hospitals, for these rare, rare instances, it's literally going to be per 1,000. We thought it wasn't going to soak up. Well, that would be my argument for it.
Nancy?
Yes, Carrie, I wanted to ask you, what you just talked about, though, you were talking about postpartum use, correct? Or time of surgery. This measure is at time of surgery.
It was very interesting because what we found, the nurses thought they had pushed the button, they weren't on correctly, and that was during our initial piece. Then we went forward, and once we really made sure everyone was really aware of all the pieces, and again, that was just a spot check over a month, but then postpartum also was included, yes.
Okay, so what you're reporting on is just not documenting at the time of surgery.
Surgery, correct.
Okay.
We have this measure as well, and what we record is in surgery, but we also look at postpartum because that's typically what we're looking at, is trying to make sure they're on after the surgery, when they're typically in bed for a little bit, after the surgery. So that would be the kind of difficult thing for us to change, is looking at just surgery. That would be a change for us because we would look at it after surgery. That would be in our data elements. The other thing is we do use pharmacologic, not just the compression boost, and I think a lot of our docs, I think we would probably meet the measure just simply from that. So it would be easier for us to track it electronically in our medical record, looking at the pharmacologic and being able to meet the measure that way versus the compression boots. They're documented, but like you said, I'm not sure how accurate that would be. Pharmacologically, it'd be easier to track.
other comments on feasibility?
This is Janet, and I think a shift that has occurred too is that what we have done is we've changed our definition to go ahead and align and harmonize with the ACOG definition. So I think some of the comments that are being brought up right now will be some of the shifts that we will see in our own use of aligning our definition.
Jean, this is for that. I wasn't totally clear. You say you have made changes to align, or you're planning to make changes?
We are in the process, but really what we're doing is we're making sure that when we capture the elements in our documentation, we're making sure that we are aligning with ACOG's data points.
But ACOG just asks. But right now we're voting on this measure, right? And ACOG really doesn't weigh in on terribly great amount of this. I mean, it basically just says, put them on a C-section, for women who aren't pharmacologically anticoagulated.
That's correct. And all I wanted to say was making sure that pharmacology was the national benefit as a practice.
Okay, so we're going ahead and voting on everything we've talked about.
Comments? Okay, let's vote on feasibility then. Okay, so we have 13 high, 11 moderate, and 1 low. And we have one final vote, and that is your judgment overall whether this measure meets all 4 of the main NQF criteria.
Am I supposed to say anything about that, or do we just...
Yes.
Hi, I just have a question. On page 10, there's a note about other competing or related measures, and if you can help me reconcile or perhaps harmonize in my brain how these relate or not, which are surgery patients who receive appropriate venous thromboembolism prophylaxis, and also, I mean, there are 3 of them listed there. So is this the same? Is it different? I mean, I know this is specific for C-section, but... It looks like there are a number of other measures that are very close, and C-section is a surgery, so.
Yeah, but C-section has never, this is like Dr. Callahan was saying, C-section has never, we can debate the historical reasons for this, but C-section has never fallen under, even though it is a major abdominal surgery,
okay,
has never somehow fallen under the rubric of other surgeries. I mean, it's just been, whatever, it's out there in its own little bubble.
Kim?
Yeah, I would actually say that the benefit of those other measures is that you can tell the hospitals to do everything you did for those other measures, just now they're pregnant women. And it actually increases the feasibility, and it means that the recording process and the documentation process is already in place, because almost all hospitals are either reporting these to the Joint Commission or as part of their SHIP measure. So every hospital could do this tomorrow if they wanted to.
Just as pregnant women join the club.
Yeah.
Other comments before the overall vote? Okay, let's go. So 21 yes and 2 no. We will be voting, recommending that the board agree to endorse this measure. Okay, Elliot, we would love to have you join us. The next measure is the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative measure number 477, that infants who weigh less than 1,500 grams are born in the appropriate facility. And Sharon Sutherland will lead this. So we'll begin with importance to measure.
Okay. So this measure was endorsed in 2008, and it's been developed by CMQCC. It measures the number of infants weighing less than 1,500 grams not delivered at a level 3 facility. The denominator are all live births of 24 and 07 weeks or more, and the numerator is of those infants, how many are born weighing less than 1,500 grams. The consensus within our work group is that under importance to measure, all three areas were either high or moderate, and we had a consensus that all five of us felt that this measure met importance. Based on impact, there is evidence to show a 60% higher mortality if very low birth weight infants are born outside of level 3 nursery. There was evidence in California data of a performance gap. It was felt that some of this gap was due to economic factors, when in fact there were level 3 centers located in a very short proximity to hospitals with lower levels of care. There was anecdotal information on the telephone call with the developer that they felt the economic factors may be more of an issue, and that transfer facilities are not being taken advantage of in a way that they should be. The benchmark proposed by the developer is that 1 to 3 per 1,000 births would be expected to occur in less than level 3 centers due to precipitous labor or geographic barriers. Evidence since this was initially proposed, a meta-analysis came out in 2010 by Laswell that showed significant survival benefit for infants weighing both less than 1,500 grams and less than 2,500 grams born in high-level centers. Any other comments?
Comments about importance?
I mean, clearly it's important that these high-risk babies go to high-level facilities, but my comment here is that the level 3 status is not consistent, you know, across the country, and I think it's just important for us to recognize that it may be consistent in California, and I think as long as we're comparing apples to apples, we're probably okay, but I'm wondering if maybe Elliot has a comment on that.
Thank you. First of all, this is a older public health measure that's been around a long time, and what we did in California was to operationalize it to be a measure of hospital performance, because it's been used at the state level for a long time, and there have been large gaps in performance and differences among states. When we initially proposed this at the last meeting of this group 3 years ago, that point was brought out, and what we've done is to use the American Academy of Pediatric definitions of level 3, recognizing that different states tweak that slightly differently to meet the local state needs. And I don't see any other way around it other than using the state's definitions of what a level 3 center is and as we go around state to state on that. I don't think there are huge differences, though, I must say, between state to state on that.
Hey, Dr. Davis. For the ACA, and I've doing an extensive study of the various states and the levels of services, of how they can define level of service, and then also looking at music definitions, and then comparing those to the American Academy of Pediatrics. There are significant differences in various states. Florida, in particular, comes to mind. They definitely have a higher birth weight newborn to be cared for. In level 2 hospitals, their level 2 definition aligns with the American Academy of Pediatrics level 3. I support the theory of newborn, lower weight newborns, including the appropriate environment and level service. I do caution on the science generalities on such that this will not take significant place without the state's environment.
Could you try to go to a better phone? Because we can hear only about every second word you say.
Does that help at all?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, that's fine. I'm sorry. I had you on speakerphone. Let me see if I can go back and just make this very brief. We did do an extensive analysis on looking at hospitals trying to do this leveling activity to assure that high-risk newborns, low birth weight babies were born in the most appropriate care setting. And based upon our extensive study in all of our various states that we have representation in, we found that there was a significant disparity between the way that states do define level of service as it aligns with the American Academy of Pediatrics level of service. And as I said, Florida was one that probably came to mind with the most discrepancy between how they define their level of service as compared to the AAPs. So while I do support the mission and the vision of this proposal, I'm just a little bit cautious in making assumptions that the states aren't going to vary that much from the AAP's definition.
Thank you. Because of time constraints, I think we're going to have to limit developer input to the measures that they are stewards of. Lee, did you have comments?
I was on the work group that discussed this at some length. And the more compelling, and I'm very cognizant of the NICU issue, at the Medicaid Director's Annual Meeting a couple of weeks ago, Texas presented on this very subject and said that one of the preliminary to looking at this issue is to conform their NICU definitions across the state. The more compelling evidence in the presentation that Dr. Main sent us to consider, I think, is that what you might think is that the incidence of this kind of inappropriate delivery would be in the rural area, the tiny small hospital, and so on, that did not prove to be true in California. And that, for me, was a pretty compelling thing, that if an inner city, major city, with all these facilities, was not delivering women who are high risk at the right place, there ought to be an effort at that city's level to do better.
Jennifer?
Just so, as a researcher and having worked with birth certificate data locally in Ohio and done a project, I would concur that the state is unpublished except in the abstract form. The rural communities do a great job of getting babies out. It's the inner city where we want the dollars, is my speculation as well, where they keep the deliveries and ship the babies. Having said that, while it's difficult if you're looking at a national data set to figure out who's really a level 3 and who's not, at the local level it's painfully obvious. So if these are looked at state level and people are looking at it at state level and each state sort of knows what their true level 1s and 2s and 3s are, I think this is a very reportable measure and that there is the possibility for AHA or somebody else to harmonize across these measures. So I wouldn't let the varying state definitions get in the way of this being a useful measure.
Other comments on importance? Okay. Let's vote on importance, please.
Hi. I guess this is the first time I've seen since I developed hospital measures, full-time pretty much. This is the first time I've seen a measure that's so system-dependent, and it's really, I'm surprised at what Lee's saying, which is the rural areas do better. But are there any, I can totally see how it works as a system or a state-level measure, but at a hospital level, are there hospitals that just, this is not actionable for them because there's nowhere to transfer these babies in a safe way, pregnant women prior to delivery in a safe way, the time is just too far. How do you account for that in the measure to make sure it's really a true measure of quality at all the hospitals you're considering including?
When we took this down to the hospital level, we looked at a couple of factors that would take that under consideration, including we had data on the length of time that the mother was at the hospital before she delivered, okay, which gets to the issue of did she come and deliver. And the average time that the mothers were there was between 8 and 12 hours. So there was plenty of time to transport moms, and they just weren't. In most
in most every state, I believe, that there are networks now for transferring babies out to level three centers. What's happened is deregionalization, and driven by economics. And this is a balancing measure to address that issue.
So just to clarify, you're wanting to report at the hospital level to drive system change, not hospital change per se. In other words, unless those regional, I'm just trying to understand the difference between reporting this at a regional level or state level and a hospital level, because you're really wanting to switch the focus. But what if you're in a state that just isn't going to support the infrastructure you need to have transfers within a reasonable amount of time?
I'm not aware of any state that doesn't support transfers of these kind of babies.
You want the hospital to do the right thing because they have incentives to maybe do the wrong thing.
I'm from a level two facility, so we do ship a lot of our babies out. And getting the babies out is usually not a problem, and it's not hard. I mean, there's multiple places we can get the babies to, but there are certain circumstances that we run into. For instance, weather sometimes is an issue for us. I mean, typically we fly them, especially if we're in a hurry, and they can't fly under the weather conditions. And we've even had blizzards where they can't come by ambulance. And so we've ended up with a baby delivering that we really didn't want to deliver. So, I mean, there are certain circumstances that happen, but they are rare. But it does happen.
And I think that fits with the 3%. We're not looking for zero here.
I just want to comment on New Jersey. We're one of the states that licenses facilities. We don't rely on AAP definitions for what's the level 1, 2, 3. We actually license hospitals. We have, certificate of need calls and the whole thing. So there can't be any mistake about where a baby's supposed to wind up. And we have a fair degree of compliance. But I just wanted to point out that the definition of appropriate level of care is often a matter of licensure rather than a squishy definition of who needs care. And there are some hospitals that aren't transferring babies because they're in hospital systems where they can call on staff that make them meet AAP standards, even though they're not licensed. And so this is a really good measure if it's licensure that is the measure.
This is my first time at NQF, but if we think, as I'm not sure what NQF can do with this, but if we think that truly this is an important measure, can we not endorse what the AAP criteria is for the definition?
If you look at the specifications, that's what's included. So that's what's in front of you to opine on.
Because it says it's defined as defined by the state or Department of Health or a similar body. Why not directly say American Academy of Pediatrics criteria?
I wish I could tell states what to do on this, but AAP has been used by many of the states, though there are individual circumstances in different states. Interestingly, some of the very rural states, like North and South Dakota, have done very, very well on this, with 96 plus percent of babies delivering in level three centers. So it certainly can be done in rural areas, but, we are 50 states, and it is tricky sometimes.
Okay, time-wise, I think we would like to move on, unless there's any other urgent comment. Could we have a vote, please, on importance to measure and report?
Yes, 25 yes, 0 no's.
Okay. Okay, Sharon, so scientific acceptability, please.
The work group felt that for scientific acceptability, the definitions were precise and there was standard reporting under state vital statistics that made this measure very reliable. The validity will require reporting of all events due to this being a rare occurrence, so we cannot sample. And I don't know if anybody has any comments about their experience with EMTALA violations. That was something that came up with the issues in the work group, if anybody has any comment on that.
I think I was on the work group. I mean, I think we may have misinterpreted the Impella violation situation, because really what it says is that you need to evaluate. You are required to evaluate someone who shows up in labor. It doesn't say that you can't then appropriately transfer them to the right place. So I think it has nothing to do with this. I think we sort of misinterpreted that on the call. And then, as Elliot already said, those patients tend to be there for 8 to 12 hours. It has nothing to do with the Impella violation. So I'm taking care of that one.
When I worked there, I was kind of surprised. I hadn't, like in my, I guess about 10 years now, because I'd never heard that being given as a reason for why a baby was born at an outlying hospital and not transferred. So it was an interesting thought, but I just never heard of that as a very, you know, common problem, I guess.
I come from a rural state, Colorado, with a lot of small hospitals and weather issues. And I'm wondering why or if there's a way to track those small hospitals with less than 50 deliveries that have been excluded.
California actually has a very large amount of small rural hospitals, big state that it is. We have a lot of weather issues in Northern California, not with snow, but with fog. And there's very rare occurrences, though. The problem with this being a rare event is that one occurrence throws you off greatly. And so we did exclude very small hospitals from the measurement for that reason. That there can be one event, and if you have 50 births, that's, you know, 5 years of events right there in that one case.
I'm from Utah, and we have a small amount also within our system. We have hospitals that are less than 50 births, and we do track this internally, and it does throw it off. It's a significant issue, and again, weather related. So I agree that we should have the exemption of the less than 50.
And indeed, they account for a very, very small amount overall of the babies not delivered at level 3 centers.
Other comments on scientific acceptability? Okay, I think we can have a vote then on this criteria. Okay, we have a unanimous result of 25 supporting and no one saying no. So we'll move on then to usability, please.
So the usability criterion was the one with the lowest consensus ratings in our work group. CMQCC proposes this measure to increase scrutiny of practice patterns and encourage hospital administration to transfer preterm labor patients when appropriate. Medi-Cal has started to track this metric in California, and it's unclear if performance will impact reimbursements. The consensus of the work group was that the public may not understand this measure, and I think, as was already brought up by Elizabeth, the issue is more that of a hospital level or an administrative level rather than one that's made one-on-one as far as at the bedside, as far as a quality measure.
Comments from others?
I guess my question is public reporting all about the consumer necessarily or some of the other stakeholders? For example, insurance companies. I'd actually be very curious to see what Joanne Armstrong says about this, because I can envision a system where you have to write a response about why that baby didn't get to the right center, and maybe it's because it was in the middle of a snowstorm, and then Medicaid accepts it or Aetna accepts it, but you have to have some sort of explanation for why.
Yeah, I would say from a health plan point of view, systems issues are very important, and I think as we move into the ACO, Accountable Care Organization environment, they're going to become even more so. So I think that's fine. Some of the health plan issues are when we go in and try to independently confirm some of the reporting, and then we have this issue of whether you're using ICD-9 and what the administrative database limitations are. So, but it's not this one. I'd say for this one, the challenge we have when we try to look at this is what you define a level 3 NICU to be.
and it's all over the board.
Kim?
I think another issue down the road, actually, if and when this gets implemented, is the ambulance. That there are times when the ambulance doesn't take them to the right level of care, and if we really want this to happen, that needs to be thought about as well. Because the ambulance is going to take them to the closest hospital, even though the most appropriate hospital may be a little bit further down the road.
I can actually speak a little bit to that because we have a very large transfer center, and we also support several county EMS systems in our emergency department. And their standard of care is to take the patient's in active labor, and that's to most EMS or at least basic EMT trained people is screaming loudly every 3 minutes. Then that means that patient needs to go to the nearest emergency department or nearest hospital. They don't get the bypass care. That's not their standard of care. Agreed. But their standard training is that they go to the nearest emergency department or the nearest hospital to be evaluated, treated, and stabilized.
I serve for... Is this on? Yeah, I think as a former hospital board member for 5 years and a hospital that delivered a lot of babies because it was the public hospital here in the District of Columbia, I can tell you that public reporting of this kind of information would make a major impact on the hospital trustees. It's the kind of thing that you might not know anything about as a member of the hospital board, but if it showed up, particularly if it were picked up by your local news shows, you would ask questions and you would try to encourage changes.
If I might add, I think one of the directions of this kind of a measure is to change systems, including things like EMS. In San Francisco, EMS providers do bypass hospitals and take them to designated higher-level obstetric facilities. So it is possible. But again, I think you need direction from quality indicators to do that.
We're a little tight on time. Any other urgent comments? Okay. Sorry. I just wanted to clarify really quickly that I think philosophically it's fine to hold hospitals, to put the locus of reporting on the hospital to drive system change to a certain degree, because hospitals are clearly critical actors within the health system. So I wasn't objecting to that per se. What I've heard from the group is hospitals can act, and it's rare that they don't have the action they need here to perform well on the measure. Okay. Could we have a vote, please, on usability? Okay, so 17 high, 8 moderate, and no lows. So let's turn finally to feasibility, please.
So the work group felt that this measure would be easy to report because it's collected in the state birth certificate data. The survey showed that less than 1% of this data was missing information that would be needed for this measure. So this, in general, got a score of 4 high and 1 moderate for feasibility in our work group.
Comments? Ready to vote? Okay, let's vote.
-2 high, 2 moderate, 0 low.
Okay, and finally, an overall suitability for endorsement vote, please.
Maybe I should have a comment in the meantime. I hope to retire this measure soon, because I think it could be fixed with appropriate incentives. So hopefully next time, next go around, it won't be an issue anymore.
Nancy? Yeah, just related to that, though. I've been in this business more than 40 years, and I remember the beginning of perinatal regionalization in Illinois, and here we are still talking about the same problem. So I doubt it highly.
Okay. One equals yes and two no, please. Okay, 25 yes and no no. Thank you. Okay. Now we're going to move on to two measures that were moved to the morning session. One is 474, birth trauma injury to neonate, an ARC measure. Do we have a developer here on the phone? Good. Okay.
Yes, this is Nana Patanchoy from AHRQ.
Welcome. And this is Chuck Dank, right?
Yes, that's right. This measure...
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that okay? Yeah, all right.
We're doing them out of order? Is that okay? Okay. Just as a little bit of context, and I just want to say that this particular measure, injury to neonate, is part of a portfolio that's implemented by AHRQ at the state level, at least. I don't know if it's implemented at other levels. It's a whole package of patient safety indicators, and it's rolled out with computer programs for analyzing universal billing records, and that's how it's used in New Jersey in any case. So the methodology, which you see here, is driven by, it's driven by the normal sort of ICD-9 code, but this is all done electronically, to my experience. And New Jersey doesn't report it back to hospitals and more than it does to the public. This measure ran into some problems, and they basically fell into two categories. And the first one was a bit of confusion because brachial plexus injuries are in fact excluded from consideration in this measure. And that was thought to be a pretty strange exclusion. The rest of the other birth injuries, most of them are associated with, I'll just say that as originally submitted, there was no real explanation for why BPIs were excluded, but the literature review that you see in the measures presentation focuses explicitly on brachial plexus injuries as an important thing to be avoided. Since that time, the developers have submitted an appendix or something, which I found on my drive here. Didn't know it was existed, but anyway, I got a chance to skim it. And I'll just read you a summary paragraph because it's not available anywhere else. In summary, the clinical evidence indicates that most depressed skull fractures and some intracranial hemorrhages are related to application of forceps. Vacuum-related subaponeurotic hemorrhages are related to how the vacuum device is applied. Most spinal cord injuries are related to entrapment of the fetal head, and most cutaneous lacerations are related to scalpel manipulation during the previous during the delivery process. So that sort of shortcoming was addressed by the developers, but still leaves a sort of an issue of whether or not brachial plexus issues should be excluded. I imagine that the logic is because shoulder dystocia is an unpredictable and hardly preventable thing, but I think it's appropriate, right, we should ask the developers to comment on that.
Yes, I can comment on that. This is Patrick Romano. This is Patrick Romano from UC Davis representing AHRQ. So first of all, let me apologize for the confusion in the submission form because we had separately submitted and discussed the literature for shoulder dystocias and for other types of birth injuries with our expert panels. And so, unfortunately, we put the wrong literature review in the document. So we apologize for that confusion. We had two separate expert panels, one focused on the obstetric side, one focused on the neonatology side, that reviewed this indicator. And both of those panels recommended excluding the brachial plexus injuries, the shoulder dystocia related injuries, the clavicular fractures as well, from the numerator specification for this indicator. So that's why this indicator, as specified, now focuses on intracranial hemorrhages, skull fractures, long bone fractures, scalpel lacerations, and the other types of nerve injuries that you see there. So the rationale for the exclusion was, as you say, primarily because of concern that many of the shoulder dystocia related injuries are transient injuries that have no particular clinical significance. The duration of the injury may be unpredictable, and the degree of preventability was uncertain. And many of the panelists felt that these complications were therefore very difficult to avoid relative to the other types of complications that remain in the indicator numerator specification.
Thank you. And that brings me to the second issue under importance that the subcommittee sort of struggled with, which is actually an extension of your comment, which is that all of these injuries seem to be sort of diverse, a little bit difficult of ascertainment perhaps, and specifically not relatable to any specific kind of quality improvement strategy which would reduce those kinds of injuries, except one. And that is one that I can vouch for being a very important one in New Jersey, which is to just section everybody. So, one of the issues that we're supposed to be considering here is the adverse consequences of measuring a certain thing in a certain way and then having the measure be gamed. So that became a serious consideration. So basically, it was a pretty split vote. It was the most diverse ranking of any of the measures in my working group, and it was based on that, the lack of a connection between a positively oriented quality improvement strategy and the sort of mixed bag of injuries that fall under this category.
All right, Dr. Romano, when I've used this measure in the past, it's been completely dominated by lacerations at C-section. Which I think the vast majority of which are minor and of no long-term consequence. Can you comment as to the construct of this measure about what proportion is taken up by the lacerations?
Yes, I think that when we examined this, but the data that I have in front of me are that two-thirds of them were actually skeletal injuries, and most of those skeletal injuries were skull fractures, and the remaining one-third were mostly in the category of lacerations. Specifically, they fall into 767.8, which is other specified birth trauma. So those two codes account for the majority, the intracranial hemorrhages, the spinal cord injuries, and the other cranial and peripheral nerve injuries together account for less than 10%. And I would say, to follow up on your comments, that, this is sort of precisely why our expert panels wanted to retain this definition where you have some components that are more common with cesarean delivery and other components that are more common with vaginal delivery or instrumented vaginal delivery. Because obviously the cutaneous lacerations, although they're not very clinically significant, they are very difficult for parents to deal with, and they are largely limited to cesarean deliveries. On the other hand, the other types of trauma here are more common with vaginal deliveries and specifically instrumented vaginal deliveries, but they get, and those categories are clearly associated with higher length of stay and higher charges. So we do have a mixture of some that are cesarean related that don't have a lot of clinical consequence that are distressing to parents, and others that have serious clinical consequences that are more common with instant and vaginal deliveries.
Please, Bill Grobin.
So I guess I would just say a couple of things. I mean, one, I think, Dr. Mano, what you brought up is this sort of balancing, though, is that it isn't, they really are so profoundly different. You know, lacerations, although clearly sad for parents, much less sad than a spinal cord injury or a major subarachnoid bleed. That would be number one. Number two, I would actually question whether or not, just from a personal experience in the last few days, whether lacerations are really just related to C-section. And for example, we just had a baby coated with a laceration from a scalp lead. That was literally just a teeny little, it was, you know, 0.3 millimeters. It was in the chart, but it got coated, it was denoted on the physical exam by the pediatrician and subsequently coded as a scalp laceration by coding people. And then and the other thing I would say is there is, and this was mentioned, a tremendous amount of ascertainment bias, because true for a facial palsy or something, that might be picked up, but the intracranial hemorrhages, that is so dependent on what kind of radiologic investigation is done. It's, and actually, I would view the documentation that was sent as of greater concern, in the sense of it's well described that those things occur with spontaneous deliveries, both bleeds and skull fractures, but yet it's rare that babies who are delivered from spontaneous deliveries get the kind of workover that babies, even asymptomatic babies, that are delivered by operative vaginal delivery receive. And so there's a tremendous amount of ascertainment, and it's also not entirely clear then that this drives quality toward any particular way, because if my rate was bad, I wouldn't know what to do.
Well, I was putting this off to the next slide, but probably it's worth talking about it right now, is that one of the scientific questions had to do with why the measure is not stratified by the method of delivery. And so, you know, and there may be a past history of that, but we'd sort of like to think about that too, as to whether stratifying it by cesarean delivery versus an attempted vaginal delivery, because I guess you get, you know, you could have both occur, you know, would actually greatly improve. We'll talk about scientific validity in a minute, but talk about how it can, you know, how we can sort of get rid of this problem of having, you know, adverse consequences in gaming. Did you, Dr. Burns, did you have something to say?
Oh, I just had a quick question. I'm just curious, in the denominator exclusions, the first one, preterm infants, I get it, but with a birth weight less than 2,000 grams, just curious why you chose 2,000. Was it because it was halfway between 1,500 and 2,500? I'm not sure.
Maybe that's what we should talk about when we get to the next slide. After this vote, that's the next thing. Isn't it? Denominator, that kind of stuff is usually the second vote? Okay.
Yes. Mary, and then we're going to need to move on because of time.
I just wanted to clarify to the, we don't actually have the evidence then for this measure. The evidence that was submitted was on shoulder dystocia. So the so we can't actually evaluate the evidence for this measure. Is that correct?
This is sent to you. Last night after we received it from ARC. It's also on the flash card. So we've given it to you as soon as we got it.
Right. The I can summarize. The last paragraph, I think, is what's relevant here. There was a study of 669 newborns at Georgetown University Hospital who had a discharge diagnosis of birth trauma. It basically concludes to say additional validation work is planned but has not yet been completed by, in collaboration with the National Perinatal Information Center. So do you want to expand on that, Dr. Roman?
No, I would just point out, I'm not sure if Janet Murray is on the phone.
Yes, I am. This is, hi.
Okay, so the National Perinatal Information Center has been a co-steward of this measure with AHRQ, and so I'll let Janet speak.
I think that the we have used the measure for reporting back to our hospitals for a number of years, and I think that there are there are a total of about 12 ICD-9 codes, I think, that it can be generated for birth trauma. This is a subset. AHRQ uses a subset of codes that are the most serious codes and are not prone to miscoding by the coders or overcoding. So it really is a subset that gets to the seriousness of the injury. We have not stratified by type of delivery, which might be something to think about. But we do plan, as I said, we have given our hospitals a lot of data over the years, and many of our member hospitals have actually used this to drill down and look at their processes around labor and delivery to see whether or not there's opportunity for improved training or decision-making during the process of the delivery to mitigate birth trauma. So we have gotten good feedback from our hospitals. I think they appreciate monitoring this measure on an ongoing basis, and many of them will include this measure in their on their dashboards that they level up to the board of directors or the quality management group.
Thank you. Laura? Quick question for you. And this may be an unfair question, but do you have any idea of what the C-section rate is in those hospitals that you do this reporting? Just out of curiosity.
Yes. I think we have about, I think it's averaging right now, it's about 34.5%. I can check that for you and give you a specific number. This is data as of 3/31/2011.
For the non-clinicians, that's high.
Yes.
A little bit higher. From a health plan perspective, that's low. National rate is 38% and 200,000 commercial births.
Right. I think we could go ahead and tell you.
Yes.
I think it's in the neighborhood of about 35.
Okay, so could we please have a vote? Importance to measure and report. Yes, says you agree that it meets criteria for impact, opportunity for improvement, and evidence.